Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we delve deeper into how the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission's plan to move city schools from the Christina School District to Red Clay will impact each district's bottom line and who may pick up the tab. Autism Delaware is prepping for one of its major fundraisers, the Walk for Autism, and trying to make people aware of its needs.
People are sometimes surprised to hear how much we do, to be honest, but then how much more there is, you know, there is to do. So it's kind of a mixed bag, I guess.
We talked to Autism Delaware officials about their work and what's next for the organization. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also welcome back political reporter James Dawson for a legislative update as the General Assembly resumes its session. And in our arts playlist, we focus on a youth art exhibition at the Delaware Art Museum. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A few weeks back, we talked about what's next for the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission and its plans. WEIC wants to move six Wilmington schools from the Christina School District into the Red Clay School District and create a weighted funding formula to finance supplemental programs for low-income students, English language learners, and children in kindergarten through third grade with special education needs. And we previously detailed how the state's looming $350 million budget shortfall may be the biggest obstacle to moving forward with any of these plans. But that may not be the only financial barrier WEIC faces. A nearly complete study of the proposal's financial impact muddies the financial waters even further. Contributor Larry Nagengast took a deeper dive into that study and found that even if state dollars are available, there are plenty of questions that remain to be answered. His piece on these issues is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and earlier this week he joined me to explain what it all means.
This is no superficial look at the numbers. It's pretty exhaustive. What went into creating this WEIC study on the cost of implementing the group's plans?
Well, WEIC created a 14-member committee, and they held six meetings starting in mid-October. The committee was also broken into three working groups that would examine specific issues, and these groups held a total of 10 additional meetings. And when they weren't meeting, the members of the committee were researching on their own, whether it was reviewing documents, communicating with others who have expertise at all levels of school finance, and the committee included representatives from both the Christina and Red Clay districts, which would be involved in this proposed reorganization. And the members also consulted with leaders in those districts as they conducted their research. And then the report, when it's finally complete, there's still some more tweaks to be done, and will be sent to the General Assembly in late March or early April, should be about 100 pages long. So it's a pretty extensive piece of work.
Let's start with the base numbers. What would this move mean, bottom line, to both Christina and Red Clay?
Okay, let's nail down some of the basic facts here first. There are six schools and eight buildings overall in Wilmington that would move from the Christina School District into Red Clay. For tax purposes, the portion of Wilmington that would move from Christina to Red Clay has an assessed property value in excess of $1 billion. That's billion with a B. There are 4,357 public school students who lived in the area who would be affected by the shift. The number that would actually move is somewhat of a variable. About 2,500 of those students now attend Christina schools, and the other 1,800 or so attend either charter schools or they've choiced into schools in other districts. As for the financials, there are two numbers that are pretty clear. Federal funds move with the student, and a little bit more than $1.8 million that's now going into Christina from the federal government would move over into Red Clay. State funds are allocated via a unit system, but the result is pretty much the same. Christina would lose about $19.9 million in state funding, and Red Clay would gain a little bit more than $19.9 million from the state.
But as the cliche goes, the devil is in the details, and that appears to be the case here as well, starting with the impact on Red Clay. What are some of the things officials and residents in Red Clay might balk at? Where might they face some additional costs?
Well, you might remember that last year, before any cost studies were done, there was a concern in Red Clay, and we're talking about school officials, parents, taxpayers in general, as well as the legislators who represent the area, that the district could be left holding the bag if the state didn't pick up the costs for the tab for costs that would be incurred beyond what the additional tax revenue generated from what had been the Christina portion of Wilmington would generate. And then sure enough, the committee found that additional costs to Red Clay could top $10.6 million. While Christina, even after losing tax revenues from its portion of Wilmington, would register a net savings of nearly $2.4 million. Now, these are just working numbers for now. Exact figures won't be known until after the plan is approved, if it's approved, and we get hard figures on how many students are actually involved in moving from one district to the other. Ultimately, the committee figures that the added costs to Red Clay would be less than that $10.6 million, which is kind of regarded as a cap, and the net savings to Christina would probably be more than the $2.4 million that was calculated. Now, in making this calculation, these extra costs to Red Clay come, for the most part, from Red Clay providing current Christina students with the same programming and services that it now provides to students who attend Red Clay schools that are located in the city of Wilmington. You might recall that 2 years ago, those schools, because they had subpar results on state tests, were designated as priority schools, and under a mandate from the state, Red Clay beefed up staffing in those buildings, adding reading and math specialists and lowering class sizes. And now there's even another layer of costs here, costs that even this committee of experts couldn't put a figure on yet, so they're labeled officially as to be determined. Those costs would be incurred when Red Clay rewires Christina buildings so they're compatible with the computer systems that students and staff use in other Red Clay schools, and when Red Clay orders new tech gear and books and instructional materials for its new students, and when it modifies the entrance areas to the Christina building so that they have the same security features that Red Clay schools now have. So you've got some figures that are known and some figures that, you know, right now still remain to be determined.
And the idea was that the state would cover many of these additional costs that Red Clay would face. But in this budget climate, that still seems somewhat unlikely, correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Everyone has been thinking all along that the state should pick up the tab. I mean, Christina certainly wouldn't want to pay for educating students who are no longer residents of its district. And the Red Clay community, especially its suburban portion, made clear last year that they consider it unfair that anyone would think that they should bear the sole burden of paying for the education of these children that are suddenly thrust into their district. That being said, the state's facing a $350 million budget gap already, and the costs that we've spoken about thus far today don't even cover the $7.5 million or more that WEIC wants the state to spend to provide supplemental funding for students in Wilmington and also downstate who are categorized as low-income students or English language learners or who are in kindergarten through third grade and have special education needs.
And we talked about Christina getting perhaps some savings out of this, at least in the baseline numbers. But is there anywhere that Christina could take a hit in this process?
Yes, and this is another one of those imponderable to be determined. What happens with Christina if some of its staff members who now work in Wilmington schools are not hired for similar jobs in Red Clay? The commission, WEIC, in its overall plan suggests that current employees retain their jobs, but in a realignment like this, there's no way of knowing for sure how many positions will be open, whether any new programs that Red Clay starts up would require credentials that some of the Christina teachers don't have right now. Now, of course, some of these Christina employees, if there's not a job for them in Red Clay, might wind up being able to fill vacancies that would naturally occur in Christina, from teachers taking leave, retirements, moving, all that sort of stuff. But what it does come down to ultimately is that Christina could take a hit in picking up some of these salary costs. We really don't know. But you know, as you mentioned, there will be a net increase in revenue for Christina, it's estimated, in the neighborhood of $2.4 million. They certainly could use some of that money to pick up the tab for surplus staffing if they're required to keep a few more people on board for a year or so.
And your piece notes that there are some other issues that could prove a bit more complicated than anticipated. Tell us about those.
Okay, yeah. You know, the devil is in the details, that's for sure. I mean, the great thing about playing God is that you're looking at this thing from the 40,000-foot level and you see how everything ought to work out. But then when you get down to all the detail work, that's when the devil gets involved. And sure enough, you know, there are questions here about who is responsible for paying off the bonds that were issued to pay for structural improvements to the Christina schools in Wilmington. Does the debt obligation stay with Christina, whose voters approved the bond issues, or does the debt move over to Red Clay, which would be operating the buildings? You know, and then if the responsibility for paying the debt service moves over to Red Clay, would the former Christina residents who become part of Red Clay be taxed at a different rate for debt service? Lawyers have given the committee different opinions. There's no recent precedent for anything like this in the state. And, you know, the state laws describe situations that could occur when multiple districts are consolidated, but they don't address what to do when part of one school district is moved into another school district. So, yeah, lots of room for confusion, lots of opportunities here for lawyers to develop conflicting opinions, which can be debated.
But I guess at a baseline, there is that kind of thought that both these districts recently passed referendums. Would voters now be paying for things that they didn't necessarily vote for when they passed those most recent referendums?
Well, yeah, there's always that possibility. And yet, on the other hand, you've got a situation here where if you're in Christina, where the district recently did approve a tax hike, and you're in that Christina portion that would move over to Red Clay, you would actually wind up be paying less in taxes in Red Clay than if you were in Christina. Now there is I think it's in state law, or if it's not, you know, there's some legal precedent for saying that, you know, you don't have to pay if you're moved from one district to another. You don't have to pay the a tax rate that you didn't vote for or didn't have the opportunity to vote for. But on the other hand, you know, certainly Christina residents aren't likely to say I'm opposed to paying less money in my property taxes. So yeah, lots of opportunity here for confusion.
And that confusion, though, I imagine, does not make it any easier to rally support to this plan, especially when you pair it with the budget situation. It seems like as you dig deeper, it becomes a lot harder perhaps to present a plan that is just easy to sell.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, taken separately, I mean, each of these issues that we've talked about is really a rather small part of the big picture. And, you know, remember, too, we're talking about just the financial implications of a possible reorganization that would affect a piece of one school district moving to another. We're not talking here yet about student assignments, staff assignments, and, you know, any of the myriad other things that aren't addressed directly financially. And in any case, each of these issues that we've talked about is a relatively small part of the picture. We're a year or two away from anything possibly being resolved, and that's why there's this great fear of the unknown. There are a lot of what-ifs here. I mean, you know, certainly I would think that lawyers and budget experts and educators can get together and come up with equitable solutions if they've got the time to sit back and work on these matters. But the sheer number of these little details can seem quite daunting before you get started. And then when you throw on top of that the budget issues that we've been talking about at the state level, and you can see why some lawmakers might not be willing to move forward before the General Assembly session ends on June 30th.
Which brings up the larger question. Is there a danger that this plan is now more likely to become one of those efforts that winds up collecting dust on a shelf, waiting to be referred to at some point in the future when the next group comes around to take a stab at these issues?
Well, yes, certainly that's a danger. I mean, just as our recent governors and the General Assembly have been kicking the budget can down the road for years, still without finding lasting solutions, the same thing could happen with the WEIC plan. I mean, as we've seen, the budget problems haven't gone away. They've just gotten greater. And the same is the case with the key problems that have damaged the quality of education in Wilmington. They've become magnified, and they've gone statewide. Low-income students are just about everywhere, and there are large concentrations of English language learners downstate as well as in Wilmington. These issues are not going away. Instead, they're becoming more serious. And if they're not addressed in a significant manner, there could well be long-term consequences, not only for all our children, but also for the state's economic growth.
Our thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. And a reminder that his latest piece on WEEC and its potential cost is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, political reporter James Dawson stops by to talk about the week at Legislative Hall as the General Assembly got back to work. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media and The Green. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Lawmakers were back in Dover this week, restarting the session after a break for budget hearings. And after a quiet start to the session, things are starting to pick up. A cabinet nominee was pulled out of limbo. Some bills started being introduced. But perhaps the most notable news this week was the latest moves made in the wake of the February prison hostage standoff at Vaughan that left one correctional officer dead. Our political reporter James Dawson has been tracking it all, and he joins us now. James, thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
Well, let's start with that prison story. Governor Carney making a bit of a pivot this week after initially saying he would wait for the results of the independent review of the incident that he ordered. He made a move to address staffing and equipment this week at prisons. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what he's proposing?
Sure. So Governor Carney immediately spent about $340,000 on new safety and communications equipment for correctional officers. The Department of Correction declined to elaborate exactly what they bought, citing security reasons. And then another $1.2 million is being proposed for new equipment in Carney's budget that's going to come out next week. They're also trying to add 75 prison guards statewide, mostly at James T. Vaughan Correctional Center, where that hostage crisis took place. And then the rest would be at Baylor Women's Prison. That's going to cost the state another $2.3 million next year if it is approved by lawmakers. And then Carney is also looking for any room in his budget where they could restructure the pay scales for these correctional officers. Union members have said for years the starting salary is too low. It's about $32,000 a year, and it's not enough to attract top talent. But we're going to see just how much money the governor has to work with starting on Monday.
I imagine the effort there also is to try to retain some of these current officers who are starting to leave in the wake of the incident, and obviously the pay there not being what they would hope it would be. Carney has also said the review will start now and no longer wait for the criminal investigation to finish. Is this kind of a matter of not being able to wait any longer and be able to actually get some things done legislatively this year?
Yeah, and he had said initially he would wait until state police finish their criminal investigation, but now says there's, quote, a sense of urgency surrounding the issue. And that could mean lawmakers or voters are pressuring him, or he's even trying to avoid a potential lawsuit from the family of Officer Stephen Floyd, who was killed in the standoff. But really, they do have plenty of time to accomplish any kind of legislative fix. The real hurdle is going to be, where is he going to get the money to do any of these action items that he might propose or the Correctional Officers Union might propose? Regardless, you just got to have money in the bank to do them.
Carney also took some heat from the Correctional Officers Union this week. It put out its list of changes that it's demanding. And the widow of the late Lieutenant Stephen Floyd, who refused to meet with Carney and is demanding to see her husband's autopsy. How much do these things put additional pressure on Carney to do or say more?
Yeah, I think they're putting a lot of pressure on Carney. So you're starting to see lawmakers being more vocal about the need to address a lot of these demands, like higher pay and more training for officers. And based on responses on social media, I mean, much of the public is siding with correctional officers as well. So Carney is taking the cautious approach, though, and he doesn't want to taint the criminal investigation that's been ongoing for a month and a half. So he's trying to strike a balance here as to what he can do and what he cannot do that potentially would jeopardize any sort of criminal proceedings that would go on in court.
Carney did get a win this week. His pick for DenRec Secretary Sean Garvin was confirmed after sitting in limbo since Republicans put up a roadblock in January. But this was still kind of a contentious vote in the end, right?
Right. So, like you said, Republicans had blocked Garvin's nomination in January when control over the Senate was split 10-10 between GOP and Democrats. And Republicans weren't a fan of Garvin for a variety of reasons, most notably his past work with the EPA. They didn't question him much during a hearing a couple months ago, which the GOP says Carney's office asked them not to, just to save time on a busy day with a lot of nominations rolling through. Governor's office denies this, by the way, but Senate Minority Whip Greg Lavelle wanted to bring him up to the podium and ask more questions on Wednesday. Garvin wasn't even in the building, and this is my fifth year covering the legislature, and I can't tell you the last time a nominee wasn't in the chamber to celebrate after the vote. Usually they get a standing ovation from everyone. Mm-hmm. They go and shake hands with the lawmakers. None none of that this time. Garvin couldn't make it to the vote, but he was sworn in just a few steps away from Legg Hall about 45 minutes later.
So we'll see what that means for Denrec going forward and how the relationship between Denrec and lawmakers goes as that moves on. We're also seeing some more significant legislation introduced. What are some of the things that are standing out to you as we get back to business a bit here?
Yeah, the biggest one is definitely Attorney General Matt Den banding together with lawmakers to rewrite Delaware's drug enforcement code. Den wouldn't comment yesterday. He referred questions to lawmakers, and the legislators that are sponsoring the bill said they wanted the AG to talk about it and declined interviews there. But it's also kind of superseding work that the Supreme Court Chief Justice Leo Strine is doing with rewriting the entire code here in Delaware, criminal code in Delaware. But his office also referred comments to the General Assembly. So we don't really know what's going on there. There's a lot of tension in the back room. But the basic premise of this is that it simplifies the number of offenses that you can be charged with that violate the state's drug laws. It eliminates aggravating factors that would make you get more prison time, essentially, if you're within 1,000 feet of a church or park. And if you're caught dealing drugs multiple times, the penalties would be more severe.
Might we see competing plans here when it's all said and done?
That I don't know, and I've been trying to get a hold on that. It is possible, since there is a task force overseeing this criminal code rewrite chaired by Senator Harris McDowell. He gave kind of a statement that didn't really say much of anything.
So we'll wait and see on that. We've also been waiting to see Governor Carney's budget. It's set to be unveiled next week. Any sense of how this is going to be rolled out or hints to what we might see?
Right now, we really don't have a clue. All we know is the latest state revenue forecast is out Monday. The presentation for the budget is on Thursday. As for hints, we just got a peek as to what he might do with corrections, but we'll be looking for any extra money he puts into that department. And for the past month or so, Carney has been touring the state asking for feedback on the budget, mostly in Republican districts, I should mention, which has been a sore subject for Democrats. And residents are saying you got to solve this problem with a mix of tax increases and spending cuts. It's going to be doubtful that he'll follow former Governor Jack Markell's plan, which really ticked off local and county governments as to which taxes he would raise and not raise. But it's not clear if there are any other lower hanging options out there that could raise significant amounts of cash.
All right. Well, stay tuned. James Dawson, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
And remember, you can keep up with all of James Dawson's coverage of politics here in the First State online anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. There's more on The Green after your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Art Museum is putting youth artwork up on its walls for the 12x12 exhibition, a showcase for First State teenagers to exhibit on a small scale. In our latest arts playlist, our Mark Earhart talks with Eliza Jarvis, the museum's school and outreach programs manager, about what makes the 12x12 so special.
The 12x12 is an annual event there at the Delaware Art Museum. Tell us about it this year.
So we have accepted 60 works of art from 60 different students. Each student was invited to submit one work that fit within the dimensions of 12 by 12 inches. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they are all 12 by 12. Some of them are smaller, like 8 by 10 or 5 by 7, but as long as they weren't any larger than that, we accepted them. And we put the call out to all Delaware students between the ages of 13 to 18, living or going to school in Delaware.
March is Youth Art Month, with this year's theme being United Through Art. How is the 12x12 exhibit reflective of that?
So in the gallery where they'll be installed, there will also be an interactive element that invites the public to create art of their own and put it up on the wall that is after that theme of United Through Art, just following along that idea of by creating and exhibiting that we're connecting to one another.
So people can come and grab a canvas and paint their own.
Yeah, we'll actually have two different size squares of paper that will be available in the gallery. We have a sitting area and a unity wall is what we're calling it, and it has wires that will have clips on it that anybody who is enjoying the artwork or walking through the gallery is welcome to sit and sketch or write a message of unity and then place it, clip it onto the wall for others to see after them. So our hope is that as the exhibition goes on, that the wall will just get more and more full and we'll have another beautiful installation in that same gallery.
And there's a big reception for this at the museum, April 13th.
So on April 13th, yeah, we have the family open house, and it's towards the end of the show run to sort of celebrate what the students have accomplished and youth art in Delaware. So it is open to the public. You don't have to have a student that is exhibited in the show. Anybody can come out and celebrate with these artists. And the whole museum will be open as we typically are on Thursday evenings. We'll have a celebratory cake and a few remarks around 6 p.m. that evening for the students near the gallery. And we'll be hosting all sorts of other activities throughout the museum. So on our lower level, we'll have activities for little guys in our kids' corner. They'll be making ice cream cone magnets as a part of our family art making activities that we host down there. There'll also be sketching available in the galleries and the interactive drawing in the 12x12 exhibit itself.
So this exhibit ties in loosely with another one of your exhibitions, No Jury, No Prizes, about the Society of Independent Artists. And for those who don't know, the SIA was a sort of kitchen sink group where any and everyone could exhibit in one place.
So we decided it was sort of a lovely coincidence that that show was going to be up at the same time. And due to the democratic nature of No Jury, No Prizes in the Society of Independent Artists, we thought it would be a nice homage to that show to hang 12x12 in the same manner. So the letter K was selected at random by our curator for the Society of Independent Artists show. So we decided to use that letter to start off our exhibition as well. And so the work in 12x12 will be hung alphabetically. The first work you see when you walk into the gallery will be by the student whose last name begins with K, and then it will follow all the way around. And once we get to Z, we start over at A, and it wraps around in that way. So it was a nice opportunity for us to tie in with something else that is going on at the museum.
Could you give us a little history of the 12x12 exhibit?
So it was created in 2012, was the first exhibition of 12x12, and that was to celebrate the Delaware Art Museum's centennial. And the 12 obviously comes from the 12x12, and we like to say that it's like getting a foot in the door of the art world, sort of a little pun on 12 inches there. And it also allows us to hang more artwork in the gallery if we keep, just practically keep a size limit on that and thus allowing us to hang more student art, which is always a great thing.
What are some of your favorite pieces at this year's exhibit?
Wow, we got so many beautiful ones. I actually just had a chance to go through them the other day, and I was really impressed to see a few pen and ink drawings. I feel like that medium is really difficult and isn't easy to accomplish well, and so I was pretty taken aback by those, as well as there's a number of digital prints that have been altered. So there's one photograph that has been cut away and built up on in relief, and so it's this lovely three-dimensional photograph, as well as other digital elements in some of the other prints that were really kind of impressive and also cool to see that these students have that ability and access to that sort of technology at their schools, that they're able to create digital prints like that and alter digital prints. So that was, I think, one of the most exciting things for me. I guess not to mention there were some really lovely just standard acrylic and watercolor pieces as well.
Thanks to our Mark Earhart and the Delaware Art Museum's Eliza Jarvis for their time this week in our arts playlist. The 12x12 exhibition is on display at the Delaware Art Museum through April 23rd. And stay with us. Enlighten Me is next, where we focus on Autism Delaware. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Autism Delaware will be busy next month. The organization holds one of its major fundraisers, the annual Walk for Autism, over the first two weekends in April. There's a walk in Lewis at Cape Henlopen State Park April 1st, then another walk a week later, April 8th, at Fox Point State Park in North Wilmington. The events are expected to draw 3,000 walkers and aim to raise $250,000 for Autism Delaware's various programs and services. In between, Autism Delaware will be at Legislative Hall April 6th for its Smart Cookie Day, bringing families affected by autism to meet with lawmakers and advocate for legislation that can help support services to those families. With all that coming up, this week's Enlighten Me focuses on Autism Delaware, as we interview the organization's Public Policy and Community Outreach Director, Alex Aldrith, and Katina Demetrio, Director of its Adult Employment Program, known as the Power Program. Alex, we'll start with you as you guys come up on your two walks for autism early next month. Can you tell us just a little bit about what Autism Delaware has been doing over the past year? Are there some accomplishments you're particularly excited about or some things you were particularly focused on?
As far as public policy and advocacy go?
Yeah.
Sure. I think our biggest accomplishment that we're the most proud of last year was that we were an integral part of a team that got a bill passed that the governor came and did the signing ceremony at our office, our Autism Delaware office in Newark. It was Senate Bill 93, and what it did was it established the Delaware Network for Excellence in Autism, which is a statewide resource center which will house training and technical assistance experts in a variety of fields that can be contracted out statewide to anywhere that would like more training and coaching as far as supporting or working with people of all ages who have autism spectrum disorder. So those people could be occupational therapists, speech therapists, behavior therapists, that kind of thing. And then they can go out to schools and they can help teachers. If they're struggling in the classroom, they can go out to state agencies. We've already been contacted by Department of Vocational Rehab. They want their staff to be trained on how to better work with when their clients come in who might be on the spectrum. And families, anyone could use this resource center. Right now, there is not. Basically, Autism Delaware is the only nonprofit organization that covers the whole state that works exclusively with this population. So, but we saw the need to have a place where people could go and talk to experts and then get actual hands-on training and coaching from those experts.
So I imagine that extends your reach significantly.
Not necessarily Autism Delaware's
right,
reach,
but
the reach, sure, absolutely, absolutely. It's so needed. I mean, the rate of growth, of people being diagnosed is huge. So, we do as much as we can at Autism Delaware, but, there's definitely room for, improvement and a lot more service providers out there. We were on the team that actually came up with the bill, actually wrote the bill.
Right.
And then Senator Margaret Rose Henry and Representative Earl Jakes were the two legislators who sort of took it on and, ran with it down it. In Dover at Lake Hall for us. So,
do you feel in a state like this that sometimes people just assume there's enough services and there's enough people involved to handle these things, and then they are somewhat surprised when it's like, well, it's really only Autism Delaware that's doing this. And
I think that's probably the case. I'm not really sure what people who aren't dealing with it on a daily basis assume.
Right.
What I can tell you is that there are people and families that I've met through my advocacy work who have moved to Delaware. Based on hearing, the level of services we have both in education and otherwise with adults, with our power program, with, we have a licensed psychologist on staff who can do assessments and therapy with the family. So, yeah, I mean, like, I think people are sometimes surprised to hear how much we do, to be honest. But then how much more there is to do. So, it's kind of a mixed bag, I guess, of people coming here and finding services and being hooked up with those resources. And, we're a small state, which is a good thing in this case, where we can collaborate and share resources statewide. So,
you mentioned the power program. It's your adult employment program. So, Katina, I'm going to turn to you at this point since that's your program. You had it reviewed by an independent outside organization this past year. Can you tell us a little bit what that review looked at and what did it wind up finding?
Absolutely. We had determined that as the numbers continue to grow for adults and transitioning youth entering into adult life and with the program, how do we continue to provide quality services to our adults? How do we grow smart? We started the program in 2007 with one person, and now we're serving over 130 individuals statewide. And one of the things that we looked at as an organization is we started to see more and more folks wanting to access our community-based services is, how are we going to do this? And how are we going to make sure that we can sustain it and continue to provide the quality services that person number one got and 250 should get, as well as the ever-changing policies that the division has, our two divisions, Voc Rehab and DDDS and training and all those. So we asked for George Tilson and Teresa Grassi to come in, and that involved a chart review, paper review, looking at our evaluations from the division, some of the funding streams, as well as a three-day tour with us. And that was interviewing our staff, interviewing our families, interviewing business partners that we had to get an idea of what was working, where there could be some improvement, and how do we move forward and continue to provide this viable service for our constituents in Delaware.
Well, let's take a step back. What services do you provide, and how does the program work?
So we are an organization that provides transitioning youth from going from school into adult life, as well as individuals that are already out of school that have an autism spectrum diagnosis. And we provide two services through the Division of Developmental Disabilities. That's our day hub community-based services, as well as through the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation and the Division of Developmental Disabilities, our vocational supported employment program. So it allows individuals that are on the spectrum to be able to have the support that's necessary for them to go to work, because we know that the individuals that we serve have some great skills that can be matched very nicely to the employers in the state of Delaware. We also know that our individuals and our families wanted something different for their students that were exiting the Delaware Autism School program, and being able to be a viable, integral part of their communities and being able to have internship opportunities, volunteer opportunities, as well as some social recreation, because as you know, we just don't go to work and go home. All we have social lives and things, and that's where Power is looking to pull all those pieces together for our families and the individuals that we serve.
So what did the review find?
So the review found that we do a lot of things good, which is also some things that we need to look and work on as we grow smart. So one of the things that came across from the evaluators is compassion and persistence of the organization, of the staff, of the individuals that we serve, that we're true to our mission, which is something that's very important for us, that we want to make sure that we are providing person-centered services for the individuals that we have. But it also found that as we grow, the upper management are still providing a lot of the day-to-day service, putting out the fires, making sure that we're supporting folks. And one of the things that came out glaring in the evaluation is looking at, if you want to continue to provide these quality, cutting-edge services, you need to look at your infrastructure, which that was not a surprise to us. Coming into this, we kind of had an idea of where we knew we needed to have improvement, but we wanted someone else to come in and look at it and pull all of the information together. And since then, we're really excited because we've been able, with board support, which is amazing, we have been able to add a level of management with county coordinators, which allows that to be support to my frontline managers all the way down to the direct support professionals, which allows myself and the assistant director to do more of the big picture items, making sure that we're in meetings with policy review for the divisions and continuing to provide information to families and to the people we serve.
So beyond that kind of immediate change to kind of help shore up the infrastructure, is there kind of a next steps part piece of this puzzle where do you go from here?
Absolutely. And that next step is building that infrastructure. How do we continue to grow our services? There is a tremendous need for our services, and people are looking to have our services. And to do that, we need to make sure that we have staff trained. So there's a recruitment and a retention piece and strategy, which is the long term. Because if we don't have staff and we don't have business partners out there that are willing to work with us to provide opportunities for employment and internship, then it'll limit the amount of people that we can serve. So that is the long term strategy right now. It's a couple pieces. Is one, have the infrastructure in place to give the managers the support they need to provide additional training above and beyond the training that we're required to have, but very specific management training for managers, because we promote within, because we want to value the staff that we have and give them the opportunity to have a career with us. So we're really looking at how do we bring in more resources to the organization, sure. Not only for our staff, but the individuals we serve. We serve folks on the spectrum. So we're looking at contracting with behavior consultants and bringing some more expertise into the program so we can have more folks across the spectrum being able to access our services and being productive in the community.
So that's one area where Autism Delaware is focused on. Alex, I'm going to come back to you and ask you as you're getting set to hold your Smart Cookie Day at Legislative Hall and kind of talking to lawmakers about what your legislative priorities are. What are those priorities? What are you guys looking to try and move forward with next?
Well, we have some very specific local state-level priorities, which is what we talk about on Smart Cookie Day, which is our annual day at Legislative Hall where we gather as many family members and self-advocates as we can. And I pre-schedule meetings with as many legislators just so they can meet people and hear from the families about their lives, their daily lives, and educate them, about what it's like. But this year we are there was another bill along with the one I talked about earlier that did not pass last year. They were kind of a package deal, but the second bill didn't even come up for a vote. So it needs to be reintroduced this year. So we'll be talking a lot about that.
What bill is that?
It was Senate Bill 92. Mm-hmm. Senator Henry will reintroduce it probably this month. It will get a new bill number.
Sure.
It doesn't have it yet because she hasn't reintroduced it. But the bottom line for that bill is to update Delaware code around the Delaware Autism Program. Mm-hmm. The Delaware Title 14 of the Delaware Code that addresses education includes the Delaware Autism Program, or DAP, and was written over 40 years ago and was written in a way to support about 150 students who had the educational classification and hasn't been updated since. So there, we do not have right now the needed staff. We have a director of the Delaware Autism Program and that's it. We have one person. Mm-hmm. And no support staff to help train in the schools and, make assessments in the schools, that kind of thing. And last year, the count that we got from the public schools was a little over 1,600 students now with the educational classification. Now, that doesn't include some students who are maybe higher functioning or don't even have that. We know that number's low is my bottom line. So it's so important that we get this bill passed this year because what it does is it gives more teeth to this director and allows this director to have staff and for equity across all 19 school districts. In other words, every school would have access to the same quality proven, training standards regardless of where the student goes to school, what school district they're in. They should have the same access, and the code needs to be updated before that can happen. And so we're rewriting the code in a way that it uses a formula so it won't have to keep being updated.
Right.
Initially, it wasn't written that way, unfortunately, and that's why it's not working. What I say to people and my advocates that come with me to talk to the legislators is to impress upon them that if, not special ed but regular ed curriculum hadn't been updated or changed in 40 years, do you think that would – Do you think that would fly, with people? And of course it wouldn't, right? That would never happen. So why are we doing it to our special education students? It makes no sense. It's totally unfair, not to give them what the accommodations and the extra help that they need simply based on an old, law or old code that was written 40 years ago and hasn't been updated since. So we're going to be pushing that very heavily this year to finally get the votes on the floor that it deserves. A couple of the other things that we'll be talking about are House Bill 12, which is sponsored by Representative Kim Williams, which would provide funding for regular special education for students in kindergarten through third grade. Right mm-hmm. now, there is no money allocated for regular special ed students until fourth grade, which was a huge shock to a lot of people, I think, because recognizing early intervention is so vital.
Right.
That we didn't know our younger kids who were fall into that regular special ed, not complex or, higher, got nothing basically until fourth grade. Those teachers get no support. The schools get no funding for it. So we are supporting her and Kim Williams and her bill, House Bill 12 too. We're also going to talk a little bit about ABLE accounts.
Mm-hmm.
which are the tax-free savings accounts that families can now open for their loved ones with a disability, any disability. The idea is that money would be spent on living, you know, for them to be more independent on living things like rent and food and that kind of thing. Delaware does not have their ABLE account open yet, but Autism Delaware is working closely with the treasurer's office on what would work best for our families. But I want our families to know there are ABLE accounts open in lots of other states that allow out-of-state buy-in. So you can open an account now. There's no reason to wait.
Yep.
If you want to start saving money now. Because you can open an account in another state like, you know, Ohio. And then when Delaware makes its decision, if you want to roll it over, you can do that for free without any penalty. So, you know, we're keeping in constant contact with the treasurer's office and hope that by the end of this year they've made their decision about whether they're going to have their own account or work with other states to have some sort of collaborative account. And the other big thing we'll be talking about with legislators this year is Medicaid. This is a federal concern right now, as well as a state level. Federally, we're of course keeping a close eye on what's happening with the repeal of the Affordable Care Act,
right,
because a big piece of that is rolling back and decreasing the people who now qualify for Medicaid that, you know, would be dropping lots of people. Unfortunately, a lot of our families rely on Medicaid. So locally here, Autism Delaware is working closely with the Division of Medicaid and Medical Assistance on their regulations being expanded as far as coverage of ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder Treatment Services. They actually came to us and wanted us to make sure what they were doing made sense. So we're just waiting for the final approval on those regulations, which will be great. They already cover lots of stuff, but this will actually expand that, as well as the lifespan waiver through Medicaid and DDDS, which we do support and we like to see, because what that'll add is supports for people on the spectrum from birth to death,
right,
where, you know, a lot of those treatment services are geared towards kids right now. The lifespan waiver will include some things that will help folks, you know, even as they get older.
Thanks to Autism Delaware's Alex Eldreth and Katina Demetrio for enlightening us this week. Again, Autism Delaware's two walks for autism are coming up April 1st at Cape Henlopen State Park in Lewis and April 8th at Fox Point State Park in North Wilmington. For more on how to participate in those events or anything else about Autism Delaware, head to their website, delautism.org. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. They're on The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We'd also like to hear from you. Send us your feedback and story ideas at our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nightengast, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart and James Dawson, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you once again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.